Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 1129. Hey, if you're a Walking Dead fan, then it might be relevant to your interest to know that the Walking Dead season 11 preview special will be live August 15th. We'll be back in our old studio that we haven't been in in like a year and a half. You know, the Talking Dead set looks like it's my loft apartment, and but it's obviously it's a television set. But we have for the last year and a half been doing the show actually from my house. So it'll be really amazing to get back into the studio, be live again. Again, that's August 15th. And then the following week, August 22nd, we'll be back with the Walking Dead season 11 premiere, followed by a live all new Talking Dead. So that is all the Walking Dead news for right now. Let's talk about you, the ID10T community, events at ID10T.com, like Ruben, who writes, "Hey, big fan of the show. Y'all are the big reason I was inspired to take action and do this thing. I was so impacted by what's going on right now with the near extinct vaquita porpoise. There are only 10 or less that exist in the world. Throughout the beginning of the pandemic till now, my girlfriend Shayla and I illustrated and wrote a children's book to help bring awareness to the situation of the vaquita. They are the most endangered marine mammal in the world and are getting caught in nets at sea from illegal poaching. We started a Kickstarter to raise just enough to actually print our book, get it into the hands of readers and pledgers, and we'll be donating the remaining copies to libraries around the world. It will be a beautiful hardbound book made with quality. Please help us spread the word." If you go to Kickstarter, you can type in Chiquita the Vaquita in the Kickstarter search bar, and you'll find it. Anything and everything is appreciated. Thank you, Ruben. Thank you so much for sharing. Events at ID10T.com for anyone else who has a thing that they would like to share or promote. This episode is Matt Damon, who's promoting Stillwater, which is in theaters today, the release of the podcast, July 30th. And this was such a wonderful conversation. I'd never met Matt Damon before. I didn't know what to expect. And I was so delighted by the conversation. It's so nice to see that, you know, people, especially on this level, literally like one of the highest grossing box office performers in the world, so down to earth, so funny, warm, friendly, and also love stand-up comedy. Like, we had a really great talk about stand-up comedy as well. So this was just an absolute pleasure to talk with Matt, and I really, really, really appreciated the hour that he took to sit down and have a chat. So here is the ID10T podcast number 1129 with Mr. Matt Damon as we roll the thing.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
What a nice background. What are all the plants in jars behind your head?
I have no idea. I'm at the One Hotel in Brooklyn, and I think it's kind of a hipster joint. And so this is like, it's like you get the sense there was like artisanal something in those jars, and now they're being repurposed, you know, to put plants in, because we don't throw anything away.
Plants and local honey. And
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Whatever it is. Friendship beads, like any kind of local beadwork is good. Is today just like a big long press day?
Yeah. I mean, some of these longer form interviews, which I really prefer, because they're just so much more natural than the 4 minute ones. Like, you know, I did a day, you know, last week where I had 60 of those in one day, where it's my record is 96 for the Rainmaker.
That's pretty sweet.
Yeah. Danny DeVito said it was the most you'd ever seen. We did 90. So we all did the whole cast, like, rotated through, and we did 96 interviews in one day. It was like,
I would imagine by like 60, you don't know who you are anymore. You don't know what words mean anymore. And you still have like 36 to go.
It gets so bad that you don't in those blitzing 4 minute ones that you have time to say basically like four things. Yeah. And you're kind of on a script at that point. And you don't know if you've said the thing to someone you've only been talking to for 2 minutes. You don't remember what you've said and you only have four things to tell them and you don't remember which ones you've said to them yet. It's really, yeah. It's, you know, and you're like, oh man, I don't know what I've said.
It's nice that it turns into a game show lightning round. You're like, what movie am I working on? Shit. Fuck. What is that? Oh shit. Who am I?
Yeah.
I think the only thing that I have, the thing that I really have to compare to that is doing stand up, having done a third show in a night, starting a bit and sort of feeling the air get sucked out of the room and then stopping and going, wait, did I already do this bit during this show? And the audience goes, yes. And
stop it.
You're like,
has that really happened to you?
Oh yeah, totally. Cause you can't, it's like when you're talking for hours, your brains, when you start kind of going into an autopilot sometimes.
Yeah. No, it makes
energy.
Sense.
Yeah.
But your stuff normally has a, it's almost built out like a play, like a theater play or a screenplay. I mean, it normally has that structure, right? Like you're not randomly, like I know I've talked to Tom Papa about it. Like he'll say, he'll try new stuff. He's got stuff that he knows kills and then he'll work new stuff in, because I'm fascinated by this exact process that you guys go through. And when I was writing Good Will Hunting, at night I didn't have anything to do and I would go to the improv and I would sit there and I would go every night of the week. So I'd go Monday through Saturday and Monday night sometimes it was just me and one other person in the place. Back then it was dead quiet, and I would sit there because it was inspiring to me to watch, you know, usually people around my age, I was like 20, 24, 25, writing, you know, like I was writing all day and then I'd come and watch them write at night. But it struck me as the bravest thing in the world, because you're writing in front of an audience. And the only way that you can write what you need to write is to fail. Right. Because that's the only place you know where the edges and boundaries are, is you got to fall on your face. And I was like fascinated by that. Anyway, so that process.
No, I mean, I love this conversation already, because I love the peering over the fence to the neighbor's house to see, like, how do they, because to your point, yes, you are writing on stage. You do form a relationship with the audience. You need the audience to sort of let you know if it's working or not. I don't know if stand-up is as much a brave thing as it is a compulsion to, mm-hmm. you know, to mm-hmm. gain the immediate attention of strangers. But I will say the thing that to me seems easier than what you do is, so you're writing Good Will Hunting all day. You have no idea how this film is going to turn out. There's so many things that have to go right that you're not going to know for probably 2 years, you know? Right. And then retrospectively, you'll be able to go, I mean, obviously in that case, it worked out brilliantly, but you have to wait to find out like what the reactions are, what the results are, so that, you know, wouldn't you say that so that you can then apply that to the next project? Here's what we learned this project. Let's do this the next time.
Yeah. But we're not, I mean, you're going in knowing, like I'd see, you know, guys are showing up and women are showing up with their notebooks.
Yeah.
Like literally reading out of their notebooks. Like, and you're going, there's no way the audience isn't going to see this for what it is, which is a test run for, and that's what was so fascinating to me, right? Was the Monday to Saturday thing. I'd go every night and I'd watch these people who were my age build their 5 minutes, like, or their 10 minutes and then crush on Saturday, you know, and Friday and Saturday, that place was heaving with people. You know, the audience was, everyone was there wanting to laugh, wanting to be entertained. And these people were sharp and they would get up and they crush. And I'd be like, it was like the most inspiring thing. But like to know that those Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, you know, that the ungainliness of that and knowing that you're going to fail.
But that's an interesting point too, because it sort of depends on like, and I think this applies to any kind of artistic endeavor, like what is failure and how do we define it? And if your goal is just to get up on stage and say it out loud, which is what you need to do sometimes, then you've succeeded, even though like the audience reaction seems to be the main goal for the main barometer for success most of the time, but sometimes it isn't. And sometimes you just got to say it out loud. And if you say it out loud, then you kind of feel the beats of it, even with two people. But I just think if you're honest with the audience, go, look, I'm working on new stuff. And so it's back to the earlier thing about how do you say a bit that you don't remember that you already said in a set? my set is like partially like 40% of it or so is I riff with the audience and then I weave in and out of bits. So there's not as much of a structure. So it's easy. If I'm not really paying attention, I can get lost and go, oh, fuck, I already. Oh, but it's fine because and let's weave this back into what you do, because I think those moments where those happen, those mistakes or when two people show up are some of the best moments, because those accidents create real authentic moments.
Sure.
And that's where the community kind of comes together and goes, oh, we were all in this together. As long as you acknowledge it and you're not bothered by it, at least outwardly, it can work. So do you see a parallel with what you do? These kinds of happy accidents or like the avoidance of perfectionism, which I think can be the enemy of art.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we look for those accidents. I mean, because that is exactly when those real things happen. And, you know, precisely at the moments that you don't expect and you haven't planned for. So yeah, without a doubt, we're doing that too. I just remember, just to go back to that, that's a really interesting that you say, what's your definition of success, right? Because for so many people, the act of standing in front of a group of strangers and trying to make them laugh is itself so terrifying, right? But if you're looking at that as, no, this is just Monday night and it's part of my process and my goal is to build a funny act, then I guess it's a different way to approach it. I just as a young writer was like, I just found it just struck me as incredibly brave. And the other thing about it, I was talking to, not to name drop, but I was having a conversation with Edge. This is years ago. And we were talking about writing in general. He was talking about songwriting. I was talking about screenwriting. And he said something really interesting. He goes, I think stand-up comedians have it the hardest. He said, I go out. He goes, if we go play somewhere, I have to play where the streets have no name. He goes,
and he's right. They do, by the way. They do.
And he goes, people will be mad if we don't play streets. And I'm like, that's true. I would be furious if I went to one of your concerts and play. He goes, we wrote that song, 30, 40 years ago. And he goes, these comedians with a joke, they can tell it once. And then they can never tell it again. You cannot tell a person the same joke twice.
It's because jokes are magic tricks. Like once you have the reveal, the surprise element is over. You know, when you two goes out on stage and they start playing that, and then like you don't go on stage as a comedian and go, what's up with farts, and hear a swell of recognition applause. You know what I mean?
Like, he's gonna do the farts thing.
Oh my god, this is the fucking best. I can't believe, and so
but that means like the point he was making was just the amount of material you guys have to generate. Over your lives is insane. It's insane because it's not, and that was what I was having the conversation with Tom Papa about, was how do you do it at your level? Like, and he was talking about having stuff that he knew killed, right, that he could do in front of an audience and working in the new stuff, right? Yeah. Like taking, all right, get them going, get them happy. And then now I'm going to walk down this path and I'm going to see where I go. And he goes, and if I would start to lose them, I could venture back into material that I had. I was like, that's really process wise, really interesting to me, because that makes total sense. It's still a terrifying proposition to me, but
you bookend it with A-list stuff so that you have like a safe zone so you don't lose the audience so much. But honestly, if you don't sweat it too much, because, for all intents and purposes, the audience is looking to you to sort of be the leader of the room. And if they feel like you can't handle that, then they'll turn on you. It's like, well, why did I come out for someone who can't? But if you don't sweat it too much and you just kind of like, then they'll forget it. Like then you move on quickly and then it's totally fine. But, it's not that for those Monday or Tuesday shows where there's only a couple people in the room or you don't have a good set that you don't, I mean, you feel bad about it, but it's just what you do with it. And also, do you find that you can do everything that you can do as long as you did what you set out to do, even if the audience doesn't always like react with, thunderous applause or laughs, you can feel okay about it. I feel like the times that you can really beat yourself up are when even if you have like a good set or a good movie or a good script or whatever, is if you feel like you didn't do everything that you were supposed to do, if you drop the ball, even if the audience doesn't know it, you still feel weird about that too. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, especially the more experience you have, the more, you know, like I feel that way about this movie. Like I, you know, there was someone who wrote a bad review of the acting in this movie in one of the British papers, and someone asked me about it. And I said, we just disagree about what good acting is, you know, like I'm just at the level, and like he's welcome to his opinion. Like I'm not at the level where I need his validation anymore.
Exactly.
I know a lot about this, and I'll put my group of friends up against his group of friends, you know, and you know, if you want to talk about what, you know, but everybody's entitled to their opinion. And I genuinely am at peace with whatever anybody thinks. I feel great about, like, the feeling I have after this performance is like what I'm chasing for the rest of my life. Like, I'm 50 now. I have done this for more of my life than I haven't. And I still love it. I really love it. And I geek out over the process, and I love every stage of, you know, production. I just love it. And I love acting, and it's a great career, but both of us are in our respective careers. Like, we get to get better at it, you know, as we get older. And there's so many careers in which, you know, I'm like athletes I've talked to who are like 35 years old and they're done. And it's like, they know so much more about the thing that they're great at, but their body won't allow them to do it anymore. And we get to keep going. And it's just, and I feel so lucky that, you know, but the feeling that I'm chasing is that feeling of just, yeah, it's exactly what you're saying. It's like, I'm completely at peace because I know what I was trying to do and I did it.
And by the way, you know, this idea of being at peace with yourself, I think is probably the most important journey we as human beings, like one of the most important personal journeys that I think people face, because I'm sure you have friends who are also like huge box office grossing stars and still never feel complete or whole or peaceful, whatever. And there is this, you know, I think it's called the hedonic hamster wheel, where it's like you keep setting a baseline. Oh, if I just get this, and then you get it and it's like, fuck, still don't feel, you know, because you're constantly searching for this external validation. And we both work in a business that is so heavily focused on external validation.
Yeah.
And so how do we not fall prey to that? And how do we, you know, how did you find that path where you realize like, hey, you know, people totally entitled to their opinions, doesn't affect me. I'm here to do what I do. I'm happy with that and peaceful with that. Did you always feel that way? Or did you have to arrive at that?
No, I think I arrived at it. I think one thing that really helped me was I had this moment that I've talked about before, the night that Ben and I won the Oscar in 1998, I was sitting there at home. It was like 4 a.m. and I was still kind of buzzing. My girlfriend at the time had gone to sleep and I was still kind of buzzing and I couldn't sleep, you know, and I was just sitting there and I was alone with this thing, this Academy Award. And I had this like voice come in. Like, it was like, I almost saw a parallel life in which I lived into my 80s without getting this and was chasing it. And it was like this weird moment, and like a voice in my head said loud and clear, thank God I didn't fuck anybody over for this.
Right.
And it was like, I got a glimpse. It's like, I got this monkey off my back at 27 years old. I don't ever want to, you know what I mean? Like, I'm good. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have to chase it. I don't have to worry about it. And I didn't hurt anybody to get this. And,
That is a really excellent point. And also, you know, just out of curiosity, from what you can remember, the difference between your expectation of that moment and then the reality of the moment, because it's so easy to idealize moments because we just think about them from one, you know, as basically like one dimension. I'll win this thing and it'll be the greatest thing ever. You know, like I was talking to someone earlier today about how life is really kind of like a Super Mario game where, you know, each level and you're like, I got through this level, and it unlocks a whole other series of, you know, monsters and villains and challenges. And even when you complete that game, then there's another Mario game you got to play. And so what was the sort of the expectation of that moment versus like the actual human reality of the moment. Do you remember that?
Well, the human reality was, it was first of all, so surreal. And also our lives were changing at exactly this. And we were becoming famous, mm-hmm. you know, at exactly this time. And that's a real mind fuck, because your life, your world changes, your subjective reality changes. It's like somebody rewrites your code in the Matrix, mm-hmm. and but only yours. So, you know, that in intellectual terms, the bigger issues are still the bigger issues, mm-hmm. you know, global warming, whatever it is, climate change, like all that stuff is still the same, but your reality will never, ever be the same. And that's a real, it's hard to wrap your brain around that. And so my recollection of that Oscar experience was, I remember saying to Sam Mendes a couple of years later when he got hit his, he said, "When's this going to sink in?" And I said, "About a year and a half." And I saw him a couple years later and he said, "You were exactly right. It was like 18 months before I realized this happened." Like it didn't feel like it was happening. It was like, it was nuts. It was just too much things were just changing too rapidly and in such a surreal way that it was more than my brain could kind of understand.
Yeah, because we're about the same age. And I remember that meteoric, I mean, it may not have seemed meteoric to you because I know you worked for like 11 years before that, you know, it's like you had this career before that happened, but then all of a sudden, you know, I don't know why I have this vivid memory of, I want to say it was like you on the cover of maybe Vanity Fair, like in a bathtub with a toothbrush in your, it was some kind of like, who's this young whippersnapper? Who's this guy think he is? And then of course I saw the movie. I was like, fuck, this movie's really good. and I feel like that ushered in sort of not like it hadn't happened before, but it seemed to usher in, at least for our generation, this era of writer performers. You know, it's like, you don't have to be just an actor. You can write, you can create, you can produce, and also be in those things as well. And so, you know, remembering that and sort of, I was creatively inspired by that because I was like, oh yeah, that's a thing you can do. You don't just have to go to auditions and wait for someone to go, okay, you seem cool enough, get in this thing, you know, like that, which is so part of what our culture is now. It seems like we take it for granted. Like, oh yeah, you should be a writer, creator, and a performer. But at the time, did that feel like a departure? Did it seem like a crazy thing for two actors to like, oh, can we really write this big movie? Like what was your thinking process about
that? Yeah, well, you know, it should be said, it would have been entirely crazy had it not been for Sylvester Stallone. Sylvester Stallone had done it with Rocky, right. And that was the two words. We, you know, whenever we got up against the wall, we would say Sylvester Stallone to one another because he did it. And every time that people said you can't do this, we would say Sylvester Stallone. He did it. So he laid the path for us to say we're attaching ourselves to this because that's what we want. Like we were actors, you know, we wrote kind of as a way to get jobs as actors. Mm-hmm. And so we wrote to our strengths, the roles that we thought we could do really well. And then attached ourselves to it. And, you know, it was a great feat of agenting by Patrick Weitzel, our agent, you know, I've been with for almost 30 years now. But he very much kind of made his bones on that movie too, because when the movie came out, everyone went, how the hell did that happen? Like what agent put this together? And it was our young agent, Patrick, you know, who was like smoke and mirrors, like, you know, was like, well, they're giving me this deal over here. You know what I mean? Like everyone realized the, you know, incredible feat of agenting that must've gone into it. And that really, so we all kind of launched with that, but it was, we were stubborn because we had seen an example of it. And that was Sylvester Stallone.
And what specifically did you study at Harvard? Did you study theater at Harvard?
No, they don't really have they didn't have a theater concentration then. It was English you could do a special concentration, but which is kind of design your own major. But I just did English. I was in English and American literature.
And you left, did you leave school to work?
Yeah, I left my sophomore year for a semester. I left my junior year, I think, for a semester. I would leave if I got a job. I was auditioning throughout college. So I'd stay in college, but if I got a part, I'd go do it.
I mean, even sort of hearing about how this all worked and how your agent kind of did this dazzling magic act, it's still, knowing what the film business was like in the 90s, which was very before, now I think we're sort of in a niche content culture, right? Where it's like, you don't necessarily need 20 million people to watch a thing. You just need a very passionate, concentrated audience to watch a thing. But even at that time, it really is unheard of. And you referenced Sylvester Stallone, but that was over 20 years previous to when you guys did this.
Right.
So as you were going along, as you're writing and saying like Sylvester Stallone, how many points along the process did it seem like, this is never going to happen? How would this happen? This is never going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, it felt certainly like a pipe dream. I mean, it felt crazy, but then, you know, Patrick somehow engineered this bidding war. And I remember it was between a Monday and a Thursday that we sold that script, that we took it out on a Monday morning. And Thursday evening, we had this deal with us attached. I mean, ironclad, like in a contract, like you cannot separate these two knuckleheads from this script. And it was over the course of 4 days. And it was just amazing. It was amazing how much our lives changed in a week. Ben was living on my couch. He had literally, it was another friend of ours from high school and I were living together, and Ben hadn't come and gotten on the lease with us because he was going to marry this girl. And then that flamed out within like a month. And so he showed up with all of his shit in our little place on Curzon Street, Curzon and Melrose. And it was a 2-bedroom apartment. And we're like, dude, we don't have room. You said you weren't living with us. You know, so he was on the couch, and he's 6'4", and like the couch was probably 6 feet. So I'd go in the living room and his legs would be dangling off the couch, and all of his shit was all over the living room, you know, suitcases with his stuff. You know, he had nowhere to go. And literally from there, we sold the script and from a Monday and a Thursday. And we went around, we had such shitty credit and so little money that when we went to move out immediately from that place, because we're like, dude, we got to get a 3-bedroom. Like, you need your own room.
With a tall bed.
With a real bed. We went around and we had, it was on the front page of Daily Variety that Ben and we sold this screenplay. And our pictures were on the front page of Daily Variety in November of 1994. And we went and bought all these copies of it. And we would go to these houses, and because people would say, you have no credit and you have no money. And we go, but look, and we'd hold the things up. We'd be like, this is us. This is us. Like, look how much we sold this thing for. This is all. Yeah. And that literally was how we rented our apartment for that next year. That is a totally true story. We literally showed them Daily Variety. And we had sold that script. I'll never forget. It was $600,000 from being fucking broke. And so Ben and I suddenly each had $300,000. Well, I mean, before taxes, but as far, that's what it said on the cover of Variety. And, you know, and we were like, we can afford rent. We'll pay up front.
Yeah, I guess in Hollywood and entertainment business, when they do a credit check, it's IMDb. Like, look, see, it's like you can see it's an actual credit that I'm getting this thing for. But to have that kind of success so quickly, a lot of people might have, like you said, been chasing that with each project, you know. But it seems like you were able to navigate pretty, you know, really well, and not have this kind of like one hit wonder syndrome, you know. And was that sort of, you're able to take that success, but then how do you smush it out of the way to refocus and not get your head stuck in the clouds when all of a sudden you have $300,000 and you're on Variety and you're doing this big movie with Robin Williams and, you know, everyone's talking about you? How do you pull your heads out of the clouds to just refocus and make it about the work?
Well, I mean, it's a massively insecure business, as you know, like nobody has job security. So nobody cares about the movie you made last year. You know what I mean? Literally nobody cares. And so I think that just was clear to me, just having been an observer of the business at that point. Like, there's no time to feel good about yourself. Like, you're on to the next one and you really got to keep your eye on the ball. Because if you make enough shitty movies, you're done. And I don't think there's any, I mean, it, you know, the phone stops ringing for everyone, you know, at one time or another, and sometimes for good. So I was always just very aware of that. You know, I never felt like, oh, I accomplished this, so I don't ever have to worry anymore. I mean, it's like, on that, when the first time I met Tom Cruise, I remember, you know, coming away from that conversation and saying to Ben, oh my God, like he doesn't have job security. Like, and it was just clear through the conversation, just the way he was thinking. It's not something he said, but it was clear to me. And I was like, there had never been a career at that point. I mean, this is in the late 90s that had only gone straight up. Like, in the history of movies, there had never been a career that had done what his did. And yet, like, he wasn't taking anything for granted. Like, and I was like, wow, like, that's telling, you know, like, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Like, this business is brutal.
Well, it is. But I think there's probably also a, you know, to use a NASA planetary term, like a Goldilocks zone, where there's a healthy amount of fear because it keeps you motivated.
Right.
But you don't want too much because then you make bad decisions or you make, you know, or you.
Well, yeah, it could wind you up doing the worst thing, which is like protecting your beachhead. Right. So that you don't make and you don't take any risks and you don't do anything interesting because you're just trying to do the thing you think people want to see. And that's right. Another recipe for disaster. Yeah.
Ooh,
and it's definitely a recipe for creative disaster, for creative right. like immolation. Right. It's just like you just don't grow as an artist if you do that.
So it's interesting you say that too, because I saw, I think maybe it was on Fallon where you were talking about Stillwater and you're like, look, this is not like a born supremacy identity, Liam Neeson type, you know, this is, you know, this guy does not go over to France and beat people up. Like it's a, you know, it's a very character driven drama, you know? And so yeah. Because of the success of, you know, like the Bourne franchise, which is fucking awesome, by the way, but did you ever during that process go, oh, I don't, these are cool. And obviously I like doing them and they're fun for me, but I don't always want to be this guy. Was that a conscious decision?
No, I mean, I think those movies are their own thing. And when I'm that guy, I'm that guy. And that's what the audience wants to see. And that's what, you know, that's what I would want to see going to one of those movies or going to one of those fucking awesome Liam Neeson movies. You know what I mean? like, you know, when he's like, I have a very particular set of skills. You're like, fuck yeah, you do, Liam. Go get him. You know, fuck him up.
See those skills.
Yeah, see him, man. But no, I felt like those movies, I always thought of them as inoculating me from the business side of things, like having a knowing that I was going to go back and do a Bourne movie in 2 years meant that I could really take whatever movie I wanted in the interim and, you know, a small part, a big part, you know, push a little bit, do something more experimental, like whatever it was, I really felt like free to kind of do what I wanted. And that was, which was a great feeling because I wasn't worried. I wasn't trying to make some kind of strategic kind of plan as to how to survive in the business. I was just doing the movies for all the right reasons.
I mean, just in terms of, and I'm asking this also, not only to find out how you navigated it, but also just for people who are making their own creative decisions. So it's sort of a question and advice kind of a thing, but this, what is it that you're following? Obviously you have a lot of experience, you know what you're doing, but when you look at a project, are you following creative inspiration, gut? Oh, this is probably a good thing to do. Is it like, oh, this is a challenging thing to do? Is it sort of an algorithm of all of those things? What is kind of guiding you, you know, because obviously I'm sure you have a lot of choices about what you get to do next.
Yeah, well, one thing I'd say to young actors, if you can choose the projects that you're in, or if you, you know, or to anybody who's is to go by director. That was always really the most important part of the equation for me. But in terms of reading scripts, it's interesting you say gut. I was going to say, yeah, gut. But gut is the product of having written screenplays, of having read, I don't know how many 10,000 screenplay. I don't know how many. I couldn't even guess as to how many screenplays I've read in my life. You know, so that's what informs your gut, right? If I read something and intuitively get a good feeling, you know, it's not just a hunch. It's also from all the work I've done, mm-hmm. reading scripts in my life. So it's a really informed kind of gut choice, but generally if I feel compelled by something or like, you know, if I'm moved by something like this movie, Stillwater, I felt just really moved by, like, I really believe the dynamics between the father and the daughter and the, and my character and Camille's character and her daughter. Like, I just really believed those dynamics. And so, you know, they felt real to me. And so it's gut on one level, but it's also, you know, I've been working hard for 30 something years to develop that gut.
Yeah. And again, you know, it sounds like you have a very healthy internal view of, you know, because at a certain point you really do have to let it go. You can't control whether people are going to see a movie. You can't control. Most of it you can't control. You can control what you do when you show up. You can control your performance, but that's kind of about it. So are you pretty good at just releasing all of that into the air?
Well, that's the reason to try to partner with the best director you can, because they control the most of what can be controlled. Right. And if you're partnered with a good one, then more often than not, they're going to be making really good decisions. So it gives your movie a better chance of being good. That's definitely why I've always thought that if you're going to have any strategy, that should be it.
And you've worked with so many filmmakers and also with Project Greenlight. When you're talking to filmmakers and they come to you, they go, Matt Damon, what do I do? I'm a young filmmaker. I just want to make a thing. I don't know. I don't know who I am. I don't know what my point of view is. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Having been so close to this process for so long and having the benefit of seeing so many filmmakers up close, what is something that you notice that is very helpful for young filmmakers when they're starting out? Like a couple of, you know, try thinking along these lines to sort of circumvent a lot of, you know, mistakes that you might make when you start out.
Well, the one thing I would say that I would tell anybody is that if you look at the list of directors I've worked with, it's pretty insane. But there's one thing that I find very interesting that they all have in common, because everybody does it differently. As Anthony Minghella once said to me, he said, we're all on an island. We don't get to visit each other's islands. We kind of run our own island, and we don't. And he goes, that's why actors tend to make really good directors, because they they're going from island hopping, and they can cherry pick from, you know, the way people do things that work for them, and put it into a process of their own. And what I find fascinating is, as different as all these directors are and their personalities are, because your personality comes out when you direct, it's just, you're under so much pressure and you're making so many decisions over such a long period of time. You can't hide from that process. And as different as all these people are, the one thing that they have in common is that they listen really intently to the ideas. As Steven Soderbergh said, I want to throw the window open as wide as I can, so that all of the ideas I'm bringing to him, all the ideas his production designer might say this, you know, all of these ideas, they can come from anywhere. And an idea isn't, I heard the Bono in this documentary about 10 years ago was talking about songwriting with U2. And he said, in our hierarchy, the musician is really low and the song is everything. And when a song walks into the room, and that's how he put it, he said, when a song walks into the room, you respect that. And like, you understand when a song walks into the room. And ideas are like that. Creative ideas are like that. When someone has one, when an idea walks into the room and you're shooting, you're like, fuck me, I know that's like, go with that. You know what I mean? And that can all, it comes from anywhere. And the enemy of good work is ego. The absolute enemy, the enemy of everything really is ego, but the enemy
1,000%
collaboration, like that the enemy is ego. It's like, it's get over yourself. And, you know, Ben always said to me when we started writing Good Will Hunting, which it was a very formal thing to say for friends who were as close as we were, but he kind of said it somewhat formally, which was, he said, judge me for how good my good ideas are, not for how bad my bad ideas are.
Oh, that's such a great point.
Such a great point, because you got to get, you know, it's like when you're writing jokes, you're barfing out all this stuff. It's like, it doesn't matter that 90% of it's not going to be usable. Right. And you can't be embarrassed about what you have to go through to get to the good shit. You know right. what I mean? It's a huge part. You got to turn the fucking faucet on. You know what yeah. I mean? And that's a, and that's a, and that can be humiliating if you don't, if you're writing with someone else, because you're going to say some stupid shit and you're going to, and you're going to have some bad ideas and you can't feel bad about that. You need to get through them, to cycle through them, because you never know what the other person's going to pick up with and run. And that's what writing with a partner is. It's the back and forth that ends. Like, people used to ask us, hey, who really wrote what, like in the, in your dialogue? I'm like, I don't fucking, that's an impossible thing to answer. We wrote it together. Like every single line. Yeah. Every single line we wrote together. I said something, then he said something, or he said something, then I said something. And then we got a line of dialogue out of it. Like it's, we, neither of us could have done this alone. And that's the point. It only is through the collaboration that we got here. And that's what movie making is, right? It's just doing that with like 50 other people.
Yeah, but keeping everyone in the same, you know, like in the same sphere so that everyone's kind of working toward the same goal. But what you're, I think what you're talking about is something that I'm not always great at remembering it, but it's being process oriented as opposed to result oriented. And sort of like what we were talking about earlier with stand up and success and failure, but knowing that, like, yes, part of the process is that a lot of these ideas won't work because you just have to, you just have to get the machine, you know, it's like, you just got to get it all working and just recognizing. And that's why it's so great to collaborate with people, because you have this unique chemistry, this chemical bond that is different with each person you collaborate with.
Yeah,
but
that's right.
It's so great to have that other person that goes, you know, that you feel the safe zone of like, I trust what they're going to say. And they're not going to be like, this is the dumbest joke ever. Get the fuck out of my house, you know, and go, well, maybe not that, but how about this? And having that freedom.
Yeah. And that's another thing I'd say too about writing with Ben, is that we never wasted a minute on diplomacy, right? We know each other so well. And when one of us has a bad idea, the other one is not shy about just instantly shutting it down and being like, that sucks. That's terrible.
And you're not personalizing that.
And you don't personalize it, because like the deep and profound respect that undergirds our friendship is never in question, right? So he could say anything to me and it wouldn't really hurt my feelings. You know what I mean?
Well, you also know his goal isn't hurt your feelings. The goal is for both of you to write the best thing that you can write.
Exactly. Exactly. And to go back to what we started on, I guess, I think we're just touching on like that 90% or whatever that percentage is of kind of humiliatingly bad ideas. Ben and I once got off on a jag where neither of us could see how bad it was. And it was a draft of Good Will Hunting that we wrote that we literally were so proud of it. And we waited 3 days to read it because we were like, we got to get some distance, man. We got to get some distance. And it was so fucking bad that we literally, were embarrassed. I think we burned it and we erased it. We were like, this is the worst thing. Nobody can know that we wrote this. Nobody, because, you know, our families and friends had read drafts of the script at that point, and we were like, this can't ever exist anywhere again. But to go back to the original point, like when you have bad ideas like that, at least we had them in that apartment and nobody ever saw it. Like nobody ever saw that draft. But like you've gone out and, you know, an audience has seen that draft of one of your, you know, it's like, that's
totally,
that's fucking heavy as far as I'm like,
I don't know. I think once you kind of get past the idea that the worst thing that can happen is that people won't laugh, you know, like it, I mean, obviously that's not the worst thing that happens. Someone could throw a bottle at you, you know, but I mean, like in general,
physically harm you because your writing is so offensive to them.
Yeah.
So terrible.
You could have a joke that's so bad that someone could get up, hit you in the face with a chair and stab you with the microphone stand, finish your set and kill.
Like that would be the worst, not even you dying. It's them like just crushing.
Yeah. It's them killing you and then killing. It's like, oh, not only was this guy terrible, but the heckler was better and performed on his corpse like that, like all those things, you know, but once you kind of,
once you're comfortable with that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but it's sort of like aversion therapy in a way, you know, but I think, especially with people with stand-up, when they go, well, I'm thinking about doing stand-up, what do I do? Well, you got to get up and do it. And the best advice I ever heard was you got to do it 100 times, because you'll know after 100 times if you're compelled to do it again, because you can have a terrible set and hate yourself and never want to leave your apartment again, but some little thing inside you goes, I need to get on stage tomorrow. I just need to do it. And if you're not compelled to do that, then it's possible that it might not be the calling, you know, for you, because, you know, your art you will do no matter what. You'll find a way to do it no matter what. Would you say that kind of works on the other end too?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. In fact, the one thing I always say is I just tell people, don't do it. They say, what should I do? I say, don't do it, because everybody told me not to do it.
Right.
You know, I didn't have, I mean, my parents were happy I was doing theater, but not that I was doing it professionally, trying to get part. They were encouraging, they were wonderful, supportive parents, but they weren't pushing me out there to do it. And everybody was like, why are you going to do that? Like, that's, you know, that business, it's terrible, right? It's brutal. And I go, but it was, as you say, it was a compulsion, and I had to do it. And, you know, if it's the equivalent of needing to get back up on stage after, you know, after the 100th time, it's like, I never questioned that this was what I wanted to do. And if I could dissuade somebody from doing it just by saying that, then they're never going to do it anyway.
Yeah. Can I ask you some parenting advice? Because my wife and I are in the process of trying to start a family, and you've had kids for a while. You have four kids. And the reason I thought to ask this is because you just said, like, oh, my parents, they were supportive, but they, you know, they were hesitant about pursuit. And it's probably just because they love you and they didn't want you to have a bad time. Like, no parent wants their kid to go through a tough time, knowing
I wouldn't, sorry to interrupt, but I wouldn't push my kids into the fucking movie business.
No, but if they wanted to, or if they wanted to do something that I often think, like, if I have a kid who's like, I want to be a free climber, and I'd be like, you know, like, I would feel my chest cave in, but I also know, like, it's not, I have to push that aside to be able to know when to say, like, but I got to support you because I love you. You know, I want to protect you, but I got to support you at the same time. So, you know, because you have a range of ages with your kids. And so how have you learned to do that throughout the process of four children?
How have I learned to
allow them to grow in ways that might be scary because you want to protect them, but knowing, like, but you got to let them go out and make their own mistakes. You got to let them go out there and pursue the things that they want to do and not fall into that trap where you're like, oh, maybe you shouldn't do this because it might be scary, you know?
Yeah. Well, luckily none of my kids are like, want to be like wingsuit flyers or anything like that. You know, they're not risk averse, but they're not particularly, they're not involved in anything that would scare the shit out of me or be impossible to let them, you know, and the nicks and scratches and the bumps and bruises are part of life and part of building resilience. And I really worry about this last 18 months, you know, just because all these kids have been separated from each other, and you know, that really, like, all of their brains are developing. Like, this is, it's going to have some impact, you know, it remains to be seen how much, but I can't wait to get them all together again with classmates and group, you know what I mean? Because you know, they need to have those experiences, and their brains are individuating it. You know, I've got two adolescents and a teenager, and then a 23-year-old who's obviously out of the nest now, but there's so much happening, and, you know, for them at this age. And, you know, a part of that is to start building their own lives and have their own experiences. And as sad as that is, it's totally necessary.
I love something you said. I think it was on Fallon too, where it's like, I'm getting eye rolls now. Nothing my kids do think is cool. They don't think it's cool anymore, which I think is kind of great in a way, because we do work in a weird business. And I often think about, like, how am I going to explain to a kid, like, this is weird. It's real, but it's not real. I wouldn't take any of it too seriously. Like, just sort of, you know, like, making sure that they stay grounded, you know, like, that always seems like a bit of a challenge in this business too.
Yeah, I mean, I guess more than anything, I want them to see how much I love my job. Like, I think that was a great thing I got from my mom. She was a professor, and even though she never had real money, she wasn't working for money. She was working because she loved her job, and that's a great thing to see as a kid. And You know, my father, by contrast, never loved his job, but made enough money, but did it to support us, and and that was the lesson we got from him, which was, if you have a family, you're going to have to do whatever you have to do to support them. And it might mean working at a job that you don't love. And so that was, we were kind of getting the same, I have one big brother, and we were getting the same message from both parents, but in different ways. And, you know, I think I ended up as, you know, going into the film business, and he ended up as an artist, and, you know, we both ended up doing exactly what we wanted to do and finding a way to make a living at it. But I think it was those were the two examples that we had. So which were great. And I always think about that with my own kids. I as goofy as my job can be sometime, I like that they can see how much I love it.
Yeah. And I also think one of the great things is that because this business encourages us to focus on ourselves a lot. Right. What I'm excited about the prospect of kids is you can't focus on yourself. You need to and I feel like that's very grounding and very healthy and very good. And that actually, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly takes the light and shines it away from you and someplace else. There was a friend of mine's mother in college explained it as when you spend your whole life protecting your heart. And then you have children and you take your heart and you put it in this other little vessel and they go off into the world and you can't, and that's where your heart is and you can't protect. It's like, but you have to let them go off into the world. And that's a pretty apt description, I think.
Well, I know, I just got a note that you have to jump to another thing really quickly, but I just want to say about Stillwater that my wife and I loved it. My wife is friends with Abby Breslin, and they did a movie together a few months ago. And the whatever that one outlet said, the performances are fucking phenomenal. Like, I'm from Tennessee, which is not technically the Midwest, but I know that guy. Guy you played. Yeah. You know, people are it's kind of funny that people are like, it's like your walk is different and it's like, yeah, acting. It's acting.
That's my job.
you don't show up as Matt Damon and say, hey, it's me, Matt Damon. I'm here to save my daughter from but it is to me, it was a very effortless performance. And even Abby was great. And the actor who played the woman,
Camille Cotin. Yeah. The
Camille Cotin. And
phenomenal.
And the little girl who plays her daughter has, some of the most nuances, like, she's phenomenal.
She's great. She's great. Like, literally the first day we were shooting with her and she left and I went up to Tom and we had wrapped and I sat down with him and we were like, all right, so this kid's pitching a no hitter. Like, how do we keep people in the dugout the fuck away from her? You know what I mean? Cause you don't want that to get corrupted. Like, we were like, how do we keep it light and fun?
Some adult leaning in and go, do this, or you should do this, or giving line readings. Or it's like, no, let her do what she's doing.
So many times it's like, Aunt Becky, don't talk to her. Like, you know,
fucking Aunt Becky again. What? I'm helping.
I'm helping. Do it. Put your hands on your hips. Now you're mad. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. But we were very like, analytical about it. We're like, what do we do? Okay, what's this, you know, what tactics do we use to keep this as light and fun as we can for this kid? Like, we got to keep this, she's intuitively so incredible, right, that we have to, it's our job not to fuck this up. She is giving us lightning in a bottle. Like, let's just, you know, like, don't tell her.
I don't know, remember if I've told the story in the podcast before, I probably have, but the exact thing that you're talking about, remember the old Charlie Brown cartoons where all the kids talked like this?
Yeah,
they all had that weird cadence.
Yeah.
I found out it was because there was one producer who gave all the kids the same line readings.
Right.
And of course, we associate it so closely with that cartoon, but it is that idea of like, one adult can really just with their own ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, just let everyone be, you know, just let everyone be.
That's the thing about keeping that window as wide open for ideas. You don't only get good ones, right? So that's director, you're like the arbiter of taste, right? You have to, definition of directing I ever heard was Steven Soderbergh said, it's like making a mile and a half mosaic from an inch, or a block and a half mosaic from an inch and a half away.
Oh, wow.
Right. Like a giant mural of like these tiny little pieces, but being right up against it. And so the director has to keep the image of the whole thing, right, to know which color they're putting in, like, you know, at every little inch of the thing. And so when those ideas come in, you know that the one where the kid talks like this is bad. And it's like, go back to the producer's tent. You're an energy vampire and you need to stay the fuck away from my actors.
Yeah, keep the window open, but also keep the back door open so some of those ideas can just blow on
breeze
through.
Right through, blow on
just
through. Breeze,
oh yeah, let's just we'll just keep that one moving. That's an idea. I cannot thank you enough for your time. This has been such a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, I had a ball, man. Thank you.
I really appreciate it. And the movie was fantastic. And I hope you have a pleasant rest of your day. Honestly, I hope you're not doing 96 of these.
No. I got one more, and then I'm done. It's a light day.
Cool, man. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Chris. See you, bud.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.